Welcome to the Eurointelligence podcast. I'm Wolfgang Munschau, and with me are Susanne Munschenk and Jack Smith. Today we'll talk about the asset sequestration scheme, as I call it, or the reparation loan to Ukraine, as it is officially called. And we want to talk about where we are, what obstacles this scheme has met, and what options there are to go forward. We will also talk about the ban on Russian gas, whether this ban will last, and where this will land us in if and when there is a peace deal, what will happen to this ban and other sanctions. Let us start our discussion with the sequestration issue. I've been following this debate for a while, and it started off as a general, let's use the Russian assets kind of talk, and you know, the people who proposed it never looked at the very complex legal issues that this involved. The money, most of the Russian money, is held at a Belgian depository called Euroclear. Some of it is also in various member states and banks, but about short of 200 billion of it lies at Euroclear in Belgium. So Belgium is the country most exposed to the situation, and Belgium has said it will not support the scheme. The Prime Minister, Bart De Wever, said that Belgium would carry enormous risk if the scheme were agreed. What the scheme is significantly more sophisticated at this current point than the original ideas of just grabbing the Russian money and giving it to Ukraine, because that's that would be sequestration, just taking the money. You could just call it, you know, you can use other names for this. But let's call it sequestration. That would have been illegal under international law. Russia could have sued the EU, and it would almost surely have won the case. So the general predisposition towards just taking the money was broadly based on lack of information about complex legal issues of international law. So what happened is that the EU Commission, with the help of some international lawyers, devised a scheme to circumvent the problem. Now, the problem arises legally because Euroclear is a massive company. If you look, I think the balance sheet of Euroclear is bigger than, you know, it's in the trillions. So this is like GDP territory for like the EU. This is like, it's not a company that makes a lot of, you know, profits or so. It's just that the fact that a lot of transactions go through their books that makes this company very big. And this company is represented pretty much everywhere in the world. So it can be held liable for any action it takes, or its host country can take against any of its depositors. So that's the source of the vulnerability. So what the EU did, and that was quite clever, there's a sort of a certain cleverness about the scheme, but in English they say too clever by half, and that is sort of where this is leading us here to. So what happened is they created a special purpose vehicle. It's a classic thing from the annals of structural finance. You create an SPV that is shielded. This is only a European company. That SPV has no international subsidiaries. This is where pretty much all the action happens. The SPV would raise the money. The SPV would give out the loan to Ukraine. The money it raises it on behalf of the EU, which then would be secured by member states. The scheme would be very similar legally to the scheme used for the recovery fund, where the EU raised money backed by future contributions from member states. It was an EU bond, and basically that pretty much the same principle is held here. The idea, however, is that Ukraine pays back, it's a loan, so around 140 billion. Ukraine would pay back the loan, but if Ukraine can't, and obviously we know it can't because the country is broke, the idea is that an international court will by then have condemned Russia to make reparation payments. And if Russia refuses to make the reparation payments, then the international court would agree, or the EU can then be in a position to actually use the money, because at that point it would be based on an international court ruling. Now, as we can see, this scheme has an awful lot of ifs and buts. It assumes that such a reparation thing will happen, that a court will make the decision, that Russia will agree to this. These are all very unlikely circumstances. So the question of the Russian asset sequestration has been postponed because under this new scheme, the money stays officially at the Euroclear account, so nothing actually happens to the money. So this is what ring fences them from this risk. But the risk happen in the future because the scheme is premised on the idea that at one point the Russian money will be sequestered because the European taxpayer is not going to pay for that. So you have basically a loan scheme that is kind of backed by two rather dodgy backers. One is the European taxpayer who doesn't want to pay for it, and that's the kind of political promise the EU leaders have made. And Ursula von der Leyen was very clear that taxpayers in Europe are not going to pay for the Ukraine war. That seems to be the political consensus. So then the other one is the Russian assets. So the asset sequestration in this scheme will still happen, but it will happen later. And, you know, later that means, you know, when I'm no longer in office, that's sort of the political calculation. It's a problem we'll give to the next guy. And it's a risk. The other members, the Belgium asked for guarantees, for complete guarantees, and guarantees also into all of the future, because it could well be that a foreign court may well declare the scheme illegal long after the Ukraine war ended. So Belgium wanted to be secure against that risk as well. And what happened is that the other member states refused to carry that risk. They said, well, this is too risky for us because foreign courts could, you know, we don't want to carry any budget risk. And if there is a negative court ruling abroad, then we would, billions of our money would be at stake. But the point is quite obvious now that Belgium would respond to this. Well, if you think it's too risky, why do you think we should?
Well, why should we do it?
Because why should we do this? I mean, we are much smaller than Russia. I mean, Belgium is a small country. You can think of it as a very small country with a very big bank. And, you know, we've had things like this in the global financial crisis, you know, small countries with big banks. We saw this in sort of like Cyprus and various sort of places in the world where small countries had big financial sectors. And we know how vulnerable these countries can get. And Belgium is a classic case. Now, Belgium isn't, you know, Euroclear is part of the plumbing infrastructure of financial markets. You know, the Euroclear is not a risky financial organization. They're a depository of people's funds. They are clearers. This is sort of, you know, the most essential conservative part of any financial system. You know, they haven't done anything wrong. And, you know, this is not the issue. The issue is that if the EU were to sequester the funds or were to agree a loan scheme where Euroclear would ultimately be forced to commit an act that would violate international law, this would have pretty damaging consequences, potentially for Belgium. Euroclear also said it would have damaging consequences for the euro area as a whole. It could lead to higher bond yields. We've made a similar argument here at Eurointelligence. It's hard to say whether that is true or not because, you know, how financial markets react at any one moment depends on many factors. It's a risk. It's also a reason why the ECB was never particularly enthusiastic about the original ideas of loan sequestration, though Christine Lagarde said she supports this particular deal, but she can't back it either because the ECB also doesn't want to be liable for any losses. And, you know, the fact that everybody is talking about this tells us that there is a legal risk to the scheme, and Belgium doesn't want to carry the list. So what will happen, my understanding is that Bart De Wever will, you know, when the European leaders will meet again in the end of this month, I think it's around the 18th, 19th of December, Bart De Wever will say that he has no promise with the schemes in principle, but, you know, the thing is not ready and you know, the risk issue has to be resolved satisfactorily and it isn't. So he will propose the short-term loan scheme. And that, to me, seems to be the way they're like, they always fudge this thing through. So this is the EU. The EU never takes any sort of binary decisions of yes or no. So they will keep this thing alive, but there will be this short-term loan, 40 billion, which will be classic EU loan backed by taxpayers. It'll be cost. It will not be this asset scheme. And then they'll meet again in a year's time when, you know, there may either be a peace deal or there may not be a peace deal. But if there is no peace deal, we would be certainly in a different situation in the war. The sequestration idea was premised on the assumption that Russia would lose. I mean, this is why you have a reparations loan. You know, losers of wars pay reparations for the damage they caused. That's usually agreed in some kind of post-war peace deal, like, you know, the what happened at Versailles when Germany had to pay reparation payments, or after the Second World War when these reparation payments were agreed. And that's sort of the loser's burden. Unlikely to happen here. Russia isn't losing the war. Obviously, the official position of the EU is that Russia is losing the war because it's the only decent thing to happen. Therefore, we can assume that there will be reparation payments. So it's a sort of a slightly absurd hypothetical premise on which a very large financial instrument is backed, which is why I think I've been going, you know, maybe almost ballistic on this issue. This is so deeply irresponsible because the EU doesn't have a plan. It doesn't have a plan to help Ukraine. I mean, there is no lack of support in words. But the fact is that France, Spain, and Italy spent virtually no money on Ukraine. Britain, as we just saw in the budget, hasn't got much fiscal scope, and the stuff is minor. And Germany has, you know, gotten rid of its fiscal rules, but already spent it on other things. They're spending it on welfare systems, on pensions, on you know, all the pork barrel projects that these two large coalition partners have had in store for their own voters, all the promises they made. There isn't money for Ukraine. The Germans have most, probably, with the 11 billion allocation for next year. The British is smaller, nothing in the same category. You know, the other European countries like Denmark, and, you know, I think Denmark spends most in terms of its GDP, but it's a small country. And Poland is spending quite a lot. But again, you know, this is not making up for the gaping hole left by the withdrawal of the United States. So that's where this loan scheme came in, because they said, okay, we can't fund this ourselves, but here's the Russian money, so let the Russians, you know, let's use the Russian money to buy arms for Ukraine. And if that scheme falters, they're basically without a scheme. And that's the situation. This is why this is so important. And it will also be important in any peace talks. It's not the main reason why these peace talks have entered such a difficult phase, but it's certainly part of the peace process, because they cannot, you know, if there ever is a peace deal, those assets will have to be unfrozen.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at who is offering support to Ukraine across Europe, it's very lopsided and very much based on basically your perception of the risk that Russia poses. So I remember earlier on, actually relatively recently, Sweden's foreign minister had said that the Nordic countries, which have a combined population of about 30 million, were collectively providing about a third of NATO's military assistance in value terms to Ukraine. So, you know, the Nordic countries, of course, are quite collectively, generally quite worried about Russia, for obvious reasons. Russia is very close to them on the Baltic Sea, to the extent that two of them, Finland and Sweden, recently joined NATO. So, but that's the dynamic that you have. And as you say, elsewhere, the support is really in terms of words and not deeds. France, Spain, Italy contributing not very much. Of course, I think there's been a lot of criticism of France over this, quite a bit less criticism of Spain and Italy over this. But then I don't think this was really going to be workable, because the entire plan was premised on asking Belgium to shoulder a huge amount of risk that even larger countries like France and Italy were simply not prepared to take on themselves at a much smaller level, right? It's very difficult to go to Belgium and say, you're going to have to bear the potential legal risk for this, when, you know, as France, you are not spending anywhere near as much as Germany or the Nordic countries on military assistance for Ukraine. And I'm sure that point came up a few times in the various discussions over this between EU governments.
I think also looking at Donald Trump and his plan, I mean, for him, sending all the Russian assets have to be unfrozen as well. I mean, from his business perspective, if he really wants to do and really establish business with Russia, which seems to be the case, we heard the messages that the hotels and in Russia and Moscow and St. Petersburg are filled with US business people trying to figure out whether or not they can make business. For this, of course, it's also very crucial for from the US perspective that these Russian assets are unfrozen, or at least used for productive purposes and for the economy rather than reparations for the Europeans. So the question is, there is a sort of a complication with US on the other side, that could also push against EU interests in this regard.
And the 29-point plan that the Europeans so vehemently reject kind of foresees the most likely compromise with the Russian assets, which is that this money will be invested in Ukraine, not sort of repatriated to Russia, and to pay for the reconstruction of Ukraine. And that's something that allows the Europeans to say, listen, we always wanted that. But it is not taken by the Europeans. It's still a Russian money. It's still the Russians deciding what to invest in. It's private Russian investment. However, it's not, obviously, there are security questions. Obviously, Russia would own assets. You know, 140 billion, say that were the sum, that would buy the Russians a lot of property. So it's not necessarily, you know, it will not weaken the Russians militarily, but it will certainly contribute to the reconstructions to Ukraine, which requires real ready available cash. So the idea of using Russian funds for this is not altogether stupid. And, you know, I mean, of the 29 plan, which was clearly not agreed with the Europeans, had the United States and Russia sharing the revenue from this. And obviously the EU would do all the payments and Russia and America get all the money. That's not a great deal for the Europeans. And, you know, I perfectly sympathize with the position that this is not... that certainly when it comes to this particular aspect, which is the one that concerns them, and obviously the possible security situation, they should be at the table, because they will be part of the solution. So I could see compromise happening of that kind, not exactly the one that was laid out in the plan, but something of the order, some kind of investment scheme where Russia would invest this money in Ukraine and administered by some independent force. It wouldn't be a European scheme. That still leaves the Europeans with a lot of unanswered questions about the peace process, which they haven't addressed. It would require reform of the EU budget. You know, Germans insist on changes in voting procedures, and I think that's also a French position. And these may not be agreed. So Ukraine's membership accession talks would be delayed. I think they're anyway delayed by the corruption scandal. This is not something that the EU can, even a benign EU cannot accept, because a lot of money will be going down the drain unless this is fixed. So I think this is a complex, sort of complex situation. Jack, what do you think are the chances of a peace deal happening in this round? It looks like it's difficult. The talks in Moscow this week did not yield a breakthrough. They talked for 5 hours, but no breakthrough. Trump himself said this is messy, like, you know, too complicated, that he likes to get involved in the details. So do you think there is a chance of a deal, or more likely not?
I think it's hard to say, but I'm not really sure that we're at the point where a breakthrough is going to be imminent. It's, of course, always really difficult to say when breakthroughs do and don't come. It seemed, for instance, with Gaza that we had, I don't know, months getting onto years of seemingly fruitless negotiations, and then all of a sudden there was a deal. Of course, this is different because Trump's ability to cajole Israel into accepting a deal in Gaza is very different to his ability to get the participants in the Russia, you know, in the war between Russia and Ukraine to do this. One thing that I do think about this in terms of whether a deal comes off or not is that there's been a lot of focus on the land thing, right? So basically where the de facto border, not the de jure one, but the de facto border after any peace agreement lies, and whether this includes all of the Donbass or not. Now, I'm not really sure that's actually going to be the most difficult sticking point in this entire arrangement. I actually think it's probably going to be the post-war security situation, and more specifically the size of the Ukrainian military and what the Ukrainian military can and can't do. Not just what it can and can't do by itself, but also what kind of assistance NATO militaries can offer to Ukraine. I think in terms of where the territory, where the de facto border will lie, and in terms of whether or not Ukraine will be able to join NATO, that is one thing. But those are going to be, I think, more difficult sticking points, not least because those elements of the post-war security situation really do definitively set whether this is going to be it or not, whether this is going to be a final and complete peace agreement, or whether another war is going to break out in several years' time. So that, I think, is why this is so important. I'm not necessarily personally really sure that we're there yet, but I am prepared to be kind of surprised by that. I also know that it's clear that Ukraine's position has shifted, at least from when the deal was initially reported. I guess Ukraine really doesn't have a choice unless it was a deal that left them in a pretty much impossible situation. They wouldn't really have a choice. But then we'll have to see what Russia comes out with. I don't know what your sense is, but that's mine.
I think, if we can learn something from the 2021 plan for Gaza, is that these are just very general templates. They put out principles, they put out big ideas, and leaving the details for negotiation. And it's in the details where the gaps are still big and so big in terms of Israel that there seems to be no coming forward into the second phase. So we're still stuck in the first phase of this ceasefire deal, which is ceasefire or not ceasefire, depends on how you look at it. But here in with the Russian, and it's the same thing. I think once the Vitkov, Steve Vitkov was talking, I mean, he was talking with the Russians for 5 hours. I think this must have been, they must have covered quite some ground in these 5 hours with various details going through it and really just establishing where are the red lines. So, I mean, Wolfgang, you once wrote there are two ways of to scoop up the deal is either the Europeans don't accept it or Putin says no. And this morning we read in the press that Putin says no, but whether or not this is a real no or whether this is just a sort of a halting technique saying well, under these conditions, no, go back to the negotiations with the others and come back to me with a proposal that I can accept. It might be just a tactic, but it's the same with Israel. Israel will always find a reason why they cannot accept this or that. So it's a question, when do you, the dynamics, when is it in everybody's interest to move forward with the deal? And in both, definitely for Israel and Hamas, that doesn't seem to be the case at the moment for different reasons, of course. But for Russia and Ukraine, the question is, do we really know where the red lines are in these details? Is it a question of detail or is it a question of principle? I mean, Jack, you alluded, that it's more a question of principle of what post-war security looks like.
The headlines I thought were misleading. And I think, media headlines have been misleading a lot of the times. And this reporting, I mean, Putin didn't, Zelensky hasn't said yes. Nobody said yes at this point. Nobody said, yeah, I've got it. We've got a deal. We say yes. No, they have discussed. This is complex. There will be lots of discussions. They're not ready. And they said they're not ready for a summit, that I believe. So there will be a lot of detailed discussions on not just 29 points or 19 points, but on many, many more points until the big thing can happen. In the end, I believe it will have to be something like an American plan, or where after all those discussions have taken place, and after the US is aware of all the small print issues that needed to be settled in such an agreement, they will have to come up with a plan. And in the end, say to both parties, look, if Russia says, you accept it, obviously there are more ways for it to fail than to succeed. Russia could say no, Ukraine could say no. It's even possible for the Europeans to sabotage it by sequestering the loan, as we just had this discussion before. I don't think that's the most likely one. I mean, Russia saying no is a possibility. Ukraine saying no is a possibility. I agree with Jack, they are in a weaker position, especially after this corruption scandal. But it's still possible that Ukraine says no. And the deal would have to come also with a very clear indication of what would happen if any of the parties says no. And it makes a difference whether Putin says no or whether Zelensky says no. If Putin says no, then the US might, continue its current level of support for Ukraine, the intelligence sharing. There's still military support going on. There's certainly political support. If Ukraine says no, we would be in a very different situation. The American would switch off the support. They might even, we heard from Scott Bessent last night. He talked about a Russian incursion into NATO territory. I'm not entirely sure what he was talking about. Probably about hybrid attacks that are supposedly done by Russia, or that Western intelligence service believe were carried out by Russia. I'm not entirely sure that this is called, this we would call this a Russian. I think if we had a Russian incursion into NATO territory, we might have seen a news story on this or two in the media. But he was saying if there is a Russian incursion, the US would not send troops. So basically, you know, this is the clearest indication yet that the US is absolutely not willing to fulfill the NATO security guarantees that the Europeans always thought they had. So this is why the Europeans and the Ukraine cannot really say no, because it would, you know, if this became sort of the formal US position, it would put Europe's security at risk when the, you know, I think when Trump's constructive ambiguity about defense turns into complete clarity that the US is absolutely not willing to honor its commitment under the NATO Article 5 clause. So I think that's why the more likely scenario, if it goes that ultimately Russia cannot accept it, because Putin thinks he can win this, certainly he can win the Donbass. On current military performance, this is not an unreasonable bet. And that's what makes these discussions so difficult, because he's asking for something that he hasn't got. Normally, that's a no-no in a peace deal. He shouldn't be doing this. But obviously, the reason he does that is he says the situation favors us. So either we'll do it militarily, or we'll get our principal war goal through non-military means. That's his negotiating position. And that's his priority. And that's why this is so difficult.
The ask is also that Ukraine substantially cuts the size of its military. And again, that is not something you can typically just ask for either. So I think the difficulty as well with getting Russia to agree to anything is also, if Trump is really trying to just do this by himself and get the Russians to agree, what leverage does he and the U.S. actually have to do this? You know, for instance, with sanctions, we can already see that there are ways in which Russia can move around these. I mean, I've just recently seen, you know, a report coming up from Goldman Sachs, which said, you know, two big Russian oil companies, Lukoil and Rosneft, recently fell under U.S. sanctions. And although exports from them are down by 1.1 million barrels a day, exports from other Russian companies that are not sanctioned are up by a million barrels a day. So, you know, the oil markets figure out how to get oil from where it is produced to where it is going very well. And I think what you can see from this is that even things like this are not necessarily going to convince Putin to accept a deal. So the question is, what could the U.S. possibly do that would?
I think this is a good time to switch or to look at your stories, Jack. You wrote about gas and oil from Russia and what the Europeans actually are doing there. And we're not talking only about sequestration, but one of the other tools, the big tools that the Europeans were using against Russia was to basically cut the European market off for Russian gas. And they seem to have agreed now on a plan on how to phase out completely from Russian gas. So just talk us a little bit through it, where we are and what to expect.
The first thing is to be clear about the intention of this plan, right? I don't really think it's about revenue, although, I mean, there's a certain moral argument, of course, about revenue. But in terms of its practical effect, the amount of money that Russia actually makes from any existing gas exports to the EU is pretty tiny. So what the, you know, EU has collectively now decided to do, because the three institutions, the Parliament, the Council, and the Commission reached an agreement on this yesterday, is that they have agreed to a stop by basically before the end of 2027 to all Russian gas imports into the EU. So from April 2026, there will be prohibitions for short-term supply of LNG, and from June that year for pipeline gas. Long-term contracts will take longer to phase out, so those will apply from the beginning of January 2027 for LNG, and at least, unless something goes wrong with storage, from the 30th of September 2027 for long-term pipeline gas imports. So the EU is obviously not importing nearly as much Russian gas as it used to. In 2021, it imported about 150 billion cubic meters of Russian gas, and that was about 40% or so of the EU's total gas imports. Now, as of last year, they imported about a third of this, So it's considerably less gas than before, but still, that would be a matter of replacing about a little bit over 50 billion cubic meters a year of gas. That's something that's, I think, certainly doable based on the way that the global LNG market is evolving and based on the EU's LNG regasification capacity. But then the question is going to be as well how this is going to factor into an eventual peace deal. I still keep a relatively open mind about this personally, because it sort of cuts both ways with the United States. On the one hand, part of this sort of plan that the United States has presented to Russia and Ukraine involves, quote unquote, reintegrating Russia into the global economy. Now, one would think that the EU maintaining its ban on the imports of Russian gas is inconsistent with this. On the other hand, of course, the most likely place that the EU, you know, the EU importers will turn to for gas if they can't get any Russian supplies is the United States. So this is ultimately something that's going to benefit U.S. LNG exporters and then indirectly Donald Trump. So I think this could really cut both ways. But it's kind of a sign, I think, firstly, of how we haven't completely severed all of these links with Russia yet, but also how this process is ongoing. It does have to be said, though, that this is more about trying to mitigate the risks of being too reliant on Russian gas in the future versus choking off a revenue stream, because the amount of money that Russia is making from gas exports to Europe currently is not going to make anywhere near much of a difference.
But I mean, is it not a question of cutting not only gas, but also the whole idea of economic cooperation? If we completely retreat from the Russian markets in terms of gas, I mean, it's not only about the gas itself, but it's also the industries that support it and the deal making that then happens between the two countries or the companies of the two countries. That is sort of, if we're imposing these restrictions, regardless of what's happening to the peace deal, would that not also frustrate any sort of economic recovery? How are we going to live with Russia next to us as a neighboring state, huge, with huge resources, with raw materials, with all these things, and pretending and putting up an iron curtain if everyone else seems to go the other way and wanting to reintegrate, the US wants to reintegrate then Russia into the international community back again, into the global economy, reestablishing economic links. Where would that leave us Europeans in this game? And I feel like we never really talked about what is post-war, what sort of relationship we're going to have with Russia. I think, well, for me, it feels like, or it reads like we are only focusing on the continuation of war, but not on the peace scenario enough actually to be ready to start from there and think about what is going to be our relationship to Russia after this war.
The Americans are already planning for a relationship after the war. Before they even, you know, have the peace, then American companies are already, as you said, waiting to conclude deals. The question that I'm asking, and I think this is indeed, I mean, I think the observation about the future of the gas ban and the consequences is very pertinent about the relationship. I mean, we are currently, and also the rhetoric is very much, clearly we're in a war, obviously, but you know, this will end. It could end, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks when if this peace deal were ever accepted, then it's over. Eventually it's over. There will come a moment when it's over. And I think it will, you know, with all these wars, the end of a war is always, it always comes as a shock when a war ends, because people are so used to the war rhetoric, suddenly, you know, different things will happen and then these questions will come up again. And then the question I often get asked when, you know, I've been to Poland several times this year, and the question that came up in every interview, every single one, is, will the Germans reopen the Nord Stream 2 pipelines, or the Nord Stream pipelines, both of them, after the war? And I was tend to say no, because that kind of reflects the current German position. But, you know, I am wondering if the US is doing all these deals with Russia, and if suddenly, you know, the sanctions are lifted, the assets aren't frozen, you know, business will return to normal, I'm absolutely sure the Germans will, you know, having lost so many export markets in the last 10 years, German industry will, you know, will return to its business with Russia. Russia is a source of raw materials for German supply chains. I'm absolutely sure about this. Now the gas situation may be different. It may be more difficult actually, or Russia may not want this. Or there are even stories that an American company might buy the Nord Stream pipeline and then sell the gas to Germany. I mean, this would be sort of the ultimate irony of the situation, having the whole thing started with a U.S. congressional legislation to impose sanctions on Nord Stream and the German entities that backed it, and obviously the Russian entities. So I think it's an open question of what happens after the war. The fact that the European discourse is not about this at the moment, I think is pretty irrelevant, because I think the European discourse is very much locked in current procedural issues, as we discussed in the early phase of this asset scheme, that you know, everyone in Europe talks about the technical details and all the obstacles to be overcome. You know, and all this sort of procedural stuff, nobody has really got a strategy. And not having a strategy means you're not thinking long term. And you know, we're not talking long term like in 30 years. We're talking about something that might happen in 1 year, in 1 year's time or 2 years' time. Quite possible that this discussion will be very different, and that Russian gas might, to some European countries, might look a lot more attractive.
I suppose. I mean, I'm pretty circumspect about this. Not so much because, well, the politics is one thing, right? That's obviously a pretty significant short to medium term obstacle. But even in the long term, I'm pretty circumspect about this, because commercially, regardless of the politics, to open, say, the Nord Stream pipelines, you would need a business case for doing so, right? And you would be talking about, I don't know, you know, something like, maybe 100 billion cubic meters worth of gas each year having to flow through these pipelines and having a customer in Europe. Now, the reality of the situation is that a lot of extra liquefied natural gas supply is going to be coming online in about the next 5 years, mostly driven by the United States, but also because of a large expansion project from Qatar. On the one hand, you have this going on. On the other hand, the demand for this LNG hasn't materialized perhaps in the way that these exporters expected when they initiated these projects, which is to say that a lot of the customers that they would have relied on have turned out to be quite a bit more price sensitive than they thought initially, basically, right? So especially when you're thinking about areas where LNG would be hypothetically competing with coal as a power generation fuel, as it's kind of, you know, there was a lot of talk about LNG being this bridge fuel, but as it turns out, actually coal might be the bridge fuel for a lot of countries. So this, I think, complicates the picture. And you have a situation here where a number of different European companies and countries really, really got burned by what happened in 2022 after the war began, when Russia suddenly stopped delivering the gas under these contracts. And, you know, well, at least one or two very big firms had to be bailed out. So I'm a little bit circumspect, because I kind of wonder whether there'll actually be enough demand for gas under the sorts of contracts that you would need for a business case in order to open up this pipeline again. But
you do have, however, the advantage that this gas is a lot cheaper than LNG. The reason the Germans didn't follow up on US requests to import more LNG during the Nord Stream days was that it was so much more expensive. And procedurally, it was more difficult, because you have to, you know, put the gas into the bottles and get it out of it again. I mean, it was a, you know, this is a reasonably complex engineering task. Whereas the gas, the pipeline gas, I mean, the infrastructure is there. Most of the money has been spent. It has to be repaired. This will cost money, but it's, you know, it's not an insuperable expense. So basically, this is there. It's not like, you know, if you're building a new Siberian pipeline to China, that's really expensive. The stuff is there, and you know, here's a source of cheap gas that could power, you know, since we're now moving away from the Green Deal, this could power our electricity supplies for a long time. I think the temptation is very strong. It's becoming an issue in German politics. I can tell you that the AfD is doubling down on the Nord Stream 2 thing. It's obviously the only party that does. But the way the German politics is going at the moment is going from, you know, from despair to desperation. The centrist coalition options are basically running out of credibility. So if the AfD will ever come into power, and I think there is a possibility that this might happen next time in 2029 or in 2033, yeah, the thing will be back on the agenda. That is certainly my assessment, my political assessment, that they will do this. And if the American administration is open to that, and we're not talking about dependency. I think there are two issues. The issue one is, will this gas flow? Issue two is, you know, do we still have 100% or 80% of our gas? Or I think it was 60%.
Well, EU overall, it was 40%, but it was quite a bit higher, obviously.
Higher for Germany, yes.
It was higher for Germany.
It started at like 20, 30%, and then it got up progressively higher. And with Nord Stream 2, it would have gotten a lot higher if it had this been on stream. And Nord Stream 1 wasn't on full capacity. It was still only on half, because the total capacity of the two pipelines is actually, you know, I don't have the numbers in my head, but it was pretty large. It could have covered a lot more than they did. So, you know, this is potentially good business. And if this is in a different political environment, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I mean, the fact is that this new world of geopolitics isn't working for the Europeans. You know, this is the export dependent. They don't have choke points. We sell luxury goods. We are mineral resource poor. We are dependent on imports for oil and gas, but also all sorts of minerals and magnets. So we don't have the stuff at home. It's not working out for the Europeans. The Russians are aggressive. The Americans becoming more aggressive. China's becoming more aggressive. Our governance systems do not stand up to this. So I think, you know, you've got to basically look, you know, if you look at the dynamics of this, the question is then, you know, what's the least bad option amongst many? And I wouldn't be surprised. It's not what I think. I think they should have done something completely different. I think they should have, you know, pooled their resources and, you know, become much more of a geopolitical actor. But, you know, I've been saying that forever. But, I mean, they're not doing that. That's basically the fact. Political union, financial union, capital markets union, the stuff we keep talking about. So it's not going to happen. So in the end, what do they do in a situation like that? They create new dependencies. Now, is it a good thing? Absolutely not. Will they do it? That's another matter.
Yeah. Now, granted, with the Nord Stream pipelines, I'm a bit more, I mean, I don't know. I'm less circumspect about the idea that Russian gas will start flowing back in maybe larger volumes, or that the ban will be overturned. I keep a more open mind on those. Nord Stream specifically, the combined capacity of Nord Stream 1 and 2, the combined maximum capacity is 110 billion cubic meters. Now, in 2021, when the EU was consuming more, you know, quite a bit more gas than it does now, and when that relationship was at its fullest, as I said before, the EU was importing 150 billion cubic meters worth of gas from Russia, and that was about two-fifths of all EU gas imports, right? For Germany, it was even higher. I think at that point, about two-thirds of Germany's gas imports were coming from Russia. Obviously, if Nord Stream 2 had come online, most of those imports would then be coming through the combined Nord Stream pipelines. So really, I don't really envisage a scenario where the pipelines open unless the relationship is something like what it was before. And I think the difficulty with that is, even if Russian gas is cheaper, it's not really the decision for these companies to make by themselves. They ultimately have investors, they have creditors, and they have insurance companies that they need to answer to. And all of these different parties have a fiduciary duty to ensure that these companies have a contingency plan in place in case something like what happened in 2022 happens. Ahead of 2022, it was relatively easy for these companies to go and say, well, you know, through everything that has happened since 1968, when the first long-term gas deal between a Western European company and a Russian company was signed, you know, through all the geopolitical conflagrations that happened in that time, the Russians didn't renege once. Well, now that has happened, you know, you've opened Pandora's box, and there will have to be some contingency plan. And the question is it going to still be such a great idea when the companies importing this gas have to factor these plans in?
Indeed. I mean, I think one can rule out a return to the status quo ante. That I think is true, that it will, you know, it will not be a dependency. I mean, the terminals have been built, the LNG terminals. So it's not, so the dependency is not as strong today as it would have been. So I think we're looking at lower volumes than before with alternative infrastructure in place. That's a different situation to what you had before. And also, not forget, this is all backed by a change in the U.S.-Russia relationship. The U.S.-Russia relationship becomes more friendly or more sort of business-like. I don't think the Europeans will be different if given their desperation. We'd always keep coming back to this complete lack of strategy in Europe. So they will do whatever, they will get the gas they need. But it was always the argument, the Russian gas is cheap. And, you know, it's a stupid geopolitical argument because, you know, the geopolitically say, okay, war is more expensive than the surcharge of other gas sources. But no one thought about that at the time. And I think I see little progress in European thinking to do it the other way around. And, you know, we don't necessarily have to have long-term contracts. And I'm beginning to think that, and also looking at the shifting politics, especially in the United States, and in Germany, I wouldn't be surprised if a degree of this, what they had before, will be restored. I mean, you know, the fact that you have the total capacity of 110 billion million cubic meters, it doesn't mean that you're using it. I mean, they didn't use it before. The Nord Stream 1 was significantly below capacity. And still worth, I mean, the attraction for them will be that this infrastructure is in place. It doesn't have to be built. It has to be repaired, but it doesn't have to be built. It's too good for investors to miss, because what will happen if the Europeans don't do this? The Americans will do this. And then the Americans will have inserted themselves as the profit-making middleman. That would be, I have to say, it would be quite stupid for the Europeans to stand aside and let the Americans do the business. And I think that will inform the debate. I think the debate that we're having now will seem, in 2 or 3 years' time after the war, would seem very, very different and very sort of like from a different age. Like all the rhetoric we're hearing in Brussels from Kaya Kallas and EU leaders, this will sound very strange listening to this in 4 or 5 years' time. I think people will say, oh my God, we're in a very different position today, and we have different issues. There will be different issues that people will be focusing on. And it will not be as Russia focused. But I may be wrong here. We may be at war with Russia by then. Who knows? This is indeed another scenario. I think on this note, we better call it a day. We will no doubt return to the subject many times going forward. So thank you for listening. Until next week.